is CBSI in the World. I'm John Batchelor. Cuba in the Ukraine conflict. How? I welcome Alison Federica for the Geopolitical Future site, a subscription site, to take us to the struggles in Cuba right now. Yes, the regime is brutal. Yes, the despots have very much intimidated the Cuban people, protesting their welfare, protesting the prices, protesting in general freedom. However, what is driving right now the concern is not necessarily liberty. It's the war in Ukraine, distracting and overwhelming Russia, the sponsor of the Cuban regime these many decades, and is being translated into brownouts throughout the country. What is to be done? Alison, a very good evening to you. The brownouts throughout Cuba, they're a result of what? Knee bone connected to the shin bone. What is driving the brownouts? Good evening to you.
Good evening to you as well. There's several different causes behind the brownouts. The two main issues are, one, the input materials, so needing the hydrocarbons that you feed into electricity generation plants, and the ability of the Cuban government to afford that input material. It's gotten increasingly expensive since the war in Ukraine started, as we've seen the jump in all energy prices. And we have also seen the Cuban regime have less revenue to work with. So that's one issue. The other main issue is that the infrastructure on the island is extremely old, and they have not been able to keep up with scheduled maintenance in many areas. And as a result of this, it's not operating the way it's supposed to. So it is more susceptible to breakdowns. It is more susceptible to accidents, as we saw recently last week with some of the fires. And it's more susceptible to lower capacity generation and not being able to meet the island's needs.
The brownouts lead to cut off in the water pumps, and that leads to a limited access to clean water. So we're talking about a human catastrophe here that's spreading from the center. But at the center is the regime that is counted upon Russia and allies such as Venezuela to provide fuel these many decades. Has that eased? You mentioned price. Are the Russians and the Venezuelans charging the high price of oil?
So the problem with Venezuela and Russia is their ability to provide sufficient capacity of oil at this point. Venezuela has been, in the past, a major contributor to Cuba's oil supplies through Petrocaribe. That has pretty much been defunct for about the last 2 or 3 years because production in Venezuela has gone down. And the type of oil that Venezuela produces needs to be mixed with a lighter crude or go through special processing. So there's a limited capacity that Cuba can get from Venezuela, and that supply has diminished over the past few years. In the case of Russia, there is energy that Russia can export to Cuba. In volume, as we've seen on the world markets, is not a problem for Russia. But the issue is, one, delivering that capacity of oil to Cuba during wartime as well, where you have limited capacity for logistics and also don't want to upset too much the United States. But also Russia needs money, and they're more interested in making large sales of oil to other buyers like China or India that are going to pay a better market rate than Cuba, which is a little bit more of a charity cause, and getting that revenue that the government so badly needs right now.
Once upon a time, the fairy tale was that Russia sent oil to Havana and Havana sent the sugar crop to Russia. Has that stopped?
There's still trade between Russia and Cuba that hasn't stopped. Russia also, for example, will send some wheat supplies to Cuba, which is also important for the island's food supplies. The sugar crop right now in Cuba is about half of what it expected and one of the lowest sugar crops that they've had in about a century. And so while Cuba does export some of the sugar that it does have, a lot of it is now being retained for domestic consumption. The volume of that sugar is going to be greatly reduced because of the poor crop showing this year.
So we are looking at an agricultural, not failure, but troubles, energy troubles. We're also looking at trade troubles with Venezuela and Russia. And then we come to the ability of the regime to count on tourism. What's happened, Alison?
So tourism has been a major player for the Cuban government because it's one of their main sources of foreign currency. And that foreign currency is what they need to be able to buy all of the imports, food and energy supplies. The problem with tourism is obviously during the pandemic, it took a huge hit in 2020, but it started to recover. And the issue that started to come up is that in the recovery, Russia actually appeared as the largest driver behind tourism in Cuba in 2021. And they were about counting on Russian tourism and also increased European tourism, which is another leading contender, to help increase the amount of tourists that they wanted to get this year, which in turn would increase the amount of dollars that the island was expecting for investments and import purchases. As a result of what we've seen going on in Ukraine, we've seen the economic chaos last much longer. We've seen inflation go up worldwide. We've seen Russians not really being able to travel internationally anymore. So you take that group off the market. And the Europeans have significantly reduced their consumption levels across the board because of all of the inflation that they're facing. And so while some are still taking vacation, many are not going to be taking trips as far as Cuba or any vacation at all because of the lack of disposable income for something like that when they've had to put more money towards food and other basic costs.
I'm looking at the numbers, Allison. Do I see this, that they were expecting 2.5 million visitors and they've only got 680,000? That's a 75% drop. That's not just a shortfall. That's as in you need a new hotel. Now, I did see a hotel collapse in Havana recently. That was in the news. Is the electricity story part of the tourism story that is just really wretchedly uncomfortable to travel to a nation where you need air conditioning and services and it's likely to cut out?
So what they have done is they have taken special precautions to prioritize the tourist industry. And so the energy that they do have and the infrastructure that they do have to support, for example, air conditioning or food supplies, a lot of that is being prioritized and funneled into the tourist industry so that the people who do come will have something to spend their money on and want to come back and want to extend their stay. The problem then also means that these resources are taken away from the domestic market and not accessible as easily for the regular Cubans that are also around.
What a surprise. The government has an answer to all of this, which is to hold wages of foreign employed workers. What does that mean? Translate, what would that look like?
So basically, one of the ways that the government is trying to deal with this problem is to find other sources of foreign currency or to find other sources of just general revenue. And one of the ways they can do this is by looking at foreign workers. And so the government controls in a large degree, who gets employed by who. So they get to decide a little bit who's eligible for foreign worker employment. And then with those wages, there's rules about what foreign companies can pay Cubans. Now, some of those companies don't necessarily always observe the Cuban government rules, but what the government can do then is weigh in on the wages, and then they can take away, imagine kind of like the IRS that can go into your paycheck if you are owing money. They can come into your paycheck and take out a chunk of it if they really wanted to. This is something that is a more regular practice in Cuba, where the government can come in, take the difference between the private salary and the public local salary, hold on to that difference for themselves, with the justification being that there are government rules for pay equality among different workers and that they want all of the workers to be getting equal pay. And the solution for that is to hold on to the foreign pay wages, which are slightly higher than the domestic wages, rather than increase domestic wages.
The way the Soviet Union used to do this, it was called, they pretend to pay us and we pretend to work. Now, that leads us to the question of the black market. I'm reading the black market value of $1 for 120 pesos. Is it pesos? Is that the local currency?
Correct.
And what the government has retreated to the black market. What was the official rate? Something like 1 to 1, 1 to 5, something ridiculous?
So it was ridiculous. So initially there were two currencies, one which was available to locals that had an exchange rate and one that was available to tourists. Then about earlier, in the wake of the pandemic, the government changed it. So in the past couple of years, it's changed from having two currencies to one single currency, where both locals and tourists had the same exchange rate. And that was at $1 to 25 pesos. So there's been a very huge difference in the exchange rate from 25 to 120, which in turn is a way for the government to try to tap into that black market, because obviously at the previous exchange rate, nobody had an interest in exchanging any dollars or hard currency that they had with the government, because the exchange rate just wasn't there. And there was a prevalent enough use of foreign currency among tourism and on the black market that they were better off just keeping the dollars, keeping the euros, and spending them on their own.
Like a Graham Greene novel, I was once wandered into the Soviet Union, and I learned what the official exchange rate and what the black market exchange rate means. I think at the time, $1 would get you maybe 5 rubles, some maybe 7. And then I was told by my traveling companions that we can get you 21 or 30, whatever, from this fellow around the block, you know, near the hotel. I stayed away from it, of course, because I'm a rule keeper, and also because I believed it was something of a threat to traveling tourists. This is the Soviet state toward the end of its career. Is there a comparable law enforcement shakedown threats in Cuba that you've heard of, that if you accept black market money, you get punished?
I have not seen that, but it's not something that you can necessarily rule out. The way it's structured, for especially for foreigners, you have your ability to pay in exchange currency, such that they're not going to crack down on foreigners. This really is a question for locals. And what the government strategy has been to deal with the locals is to, as you mentioned, lean in more to the black market. So, for example, in addition to improving the exchange rate to get people to use the currency interchangeably with the government, they've also created special grocery stores where if you have hard foreign currency, you are eligible to go to local grocery stores and purchase food items that are either scarce or impossible to come by in local grocery markets. And so in this sense, the government is trying to crack down by controlling where you can spend your money and also incentivizing the locals to spend their money in certain locations that result in the hard currency getting turned over to the government in exchange for the Cubans either getting better terms for their exchange rate or access to supplies that they would normally not be able to get through the local market.
I'm speaking with Alison Federka, an analyst with Geopolitical Futures, a subscription site, about the troubles in Cuba. When we come back, what is to be done? I'm John Batchelor.
Stay tuned for more of CBS Eye on the World with John Batchelor.